The last two Dick Wordley lunches, the guest speakers have been Ray Martin and Philip Adams. This year we have Peter Meakin from Channel 9, the News and Current Affairs Director. The Lord Mayor, Alfred Wong, asked me why we call this a press club when we have a strong representation from the electronic media. And I suppose when you think about it, it is a throwback to an earlier, gentler day when pre-1956, when we didn't have television. But the Canberra Press Club is a well-known speaking venue across Australia, and I guess we took our lead from them. But today, certainly Peter Meakin is not from the press, although he started with the press in 1959 with the Adelaide Advertiser, a great training ground for good journalism. Peter was born in England. He moved to Adelaide in the 1950s. He joined the Advertiser as a copy boy. We still have that system going. Before switching to television in 1966 as news director of SES 8 in Mount Gambier. And he then moved to Perth. In 1969, he moved on to Sydney as news director at 10. And in 73, he first became involved with the Nine Network. He's worked as executive producer of 60 Minutes, Sunday, and Business Sunday before moving his current position in 1993. Peter is also responsible for the lifestyle shows, which are gaining in popularity. I feel guilty if I don't watch them these days. Things like Our House and Money and Good Medicine and so on. And he fits absolutely into the criteria of the type of speaker that this club welcomes. I read during the week in the Advertiser, Peter was quoted as saying that he thought he'd need a flak jacket to fend off the questions from the waiting media. I'm not sure it's that bad, but about two doors down there is an army disposal shop. So as I was walking down here, I went in there and I said, "Do you have a flak jacket?" And this young man said, "What do you want it for?" And I said, "Well, we've got a guest speaker at a lunch who's may need to fend off the arrows and barbs from the press." And he showed me this thing that you could have shot a pea through, and I thought, that's not going to be strong enough. So I bought something else. I bought you a pair of stripes, which you can sew onto your sleeve to give yourself a little more authority when you get back to Channel 9. Today's guest speaker, Peter Meakin.
Geez, what a crowd. I'm enormously privileged to be here today, particularly following Ray Martin and Philip Adams, who are two very senior figures of the Australian media. And I also feel very much like a prodigal son, returning home after 36 years, if only for a day. I appreciate, as the prodigal son, I deserve the fatted calf, and I got that instead of the rubber chicken, so thank you for that too. First of all, I'd like to pass on my congratulations and warm regards to the Wordley family, to you, my Lord Mayor, distinguished guests, and fellow searchers for the truth. Dick Wordley was an amazing character. Nothing like the journos we were encouraged to revere in the good old days at the Taza. Dick was passionate. He enjoyed a drink. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And nailed his colours to the mast. He may have been a bit too keen to consult clairvoyants on murder cases, and a little too quick to dig up the concrete, but what the heck. I knew him for about 30 years, and I got to know him really well about 20 years ago, when I was 2IC at 60 Minutes. I persuaded the then executive producer, Gerald Stone, that Dick's hobby of repossessing children abducted by non-custodial parents might be a good yarn. And Dick agreed to go along, and we followed him to Spain, where he eventually made his move with much panache in a restaurant, grabbed his quarry, and fled to the coast with the Guardia Civil in hot pursuit. It was a little too much for our freelance cameraman, who decided his liberty was worth far more than a story for 60 minutes. So our report ended with still pictures on a fishing boat with our glorious raiding party seeking refuge in Gibraltar. Wasn't a bad yarn. Dick was deeply offended by the title on the opening graphic because we called him the kidnapper. Still, he kept calling me, almost always with stories of crime and corruption. Dick always seemed to me to have a hotline to hell. He helped us break many stories in the years that followed, and I was always impressed by his passionate regard for justice and his hatred of injustice. You couldn't shut him up. And he usually reversed the charges, which meant that for a while my phone bill was roughly equivalent to Peter Reese. Working with Dick was a vastly different experience from the dusty, desiccated corridors of the Advertiser when I was there. I was taught a number of things at the Advertiser, though, for which I'm grateful. I was taught good grammar and the importance of being able to write Pittman's at 120 words a minute. I never made it. But there were some good journos there, and I think some of them are still alive, and I've never seen them since, but I regard them and I remember them very fondly. People like Max Fatchen, Stuart Coburn, Des Cahoon, one of the best writers for newspapers I've ever met. But most of the sentences at the Advertiser in those days seemed to me to be all wrong and back to front. And I've written one down, way back in 1959 or 60, I think it was. This is from the Advertiser in those days. South Australia had a long and prosperous future provided the trade union movement dropped its ridiculous demand for a 50-hour week and the cherry harvest didn't fail, the Premier Sir Thomas Playford said yesterday. I also recall that in those days the Advertiser used to run half-column photographs, that's, you know, about that size. Regular readers were rewarded at Christmas time with a magnifying glass. Coward I was, I couldn't see any future there, so I fled to the sunrise industry of television. Well, it was sort of television in those days. My first job, as Rex said, was news director. Not bad, eh? News director at the age of 24. The station was SES 8 Mount Gambier, wedged between the cemetery and the legendary Blue Lake. Well, that seemed to me at the time was a bit more like between the devil and the deep blue sea. And I have to admit, but while I was news director, I was also the only employee in the newsroom. I had to write and edit 6 30-minute bulletins a week and a 15-minute show on Sunday. I was also required to shoot all the local film, sort of fates and car crashes and stuff like that. And I made up the reel of all the stories, but I wasn't the newsreader. Thank God. I lacked the charisma to do that. They hired the local accountant instead. After a while, I was joined by a deputy news director, Richard Winkie, who's accused me in the past of ignoring his Herculean contributions to the work at SES 8. Well, Richard, thanks for everything, but remember, you left before I did. They were the good old days, or they didn't seem like that at the time. There was no current affairs on commercial television then, only news. And if a big story broke overseas, you had to wait 2 or 3 days for the pictures to arrive by plane. Yes, we did have planes. That was long before the time that vinegary television writers, some of whom are present here today, I see, started asking whether television news was information or entertainment. That was far too deep for us at the time. We didn't even know if our industry and our jobs would last. But circuitously, we've got to the point. One of the points I want to address today about news, is it information or is it entertainment? In my view, journalists have always sought to entertain their readers. Long before John Logie Baird tuned in his black and white television set for the first time. It was in 1914 that Elbert Hubbard, and he wasn't referring to television in 1914, he said an editor's job was to separate the wheat from the chaff and to make certain that the chaff was printed. Now, as working journalists, we know that facts do not speak for themselves. Our job is to arrange them in a palatable order and eliminate the irrelevant. And the boring bits as well, of course. And I don't see any shame in that, provided we're not guilty of oversimplification or distortion. But of course, not everyone agrees with me. I'm referring to the WBD School of Journalism. WBD, incidentally, stands for Worthy But Dull. To them, to students of that school, information is like medicine. If you like it, it's not doing you any good. My point is there's no point in having the best story in the world if no one's prepared to sit and listen. What service do we do to any good cause by making it indigestible and sending the nation into a coma? We have the ABC for that. The challenge for all journalists, not just those of us who work in television, is to tell an important story in an interesting way. And I'll be honest, in commercial television, there's a performance imperative. In prime time, we have to attract a mass audience. Now, I don't make any apologies for that. It's a case of popular or perish. And yes, some issues at face value don't get the turnstiles clicking. We've all heard the dictum that Aboriginal stories don't rate, that complicated economic or legal issues are beyond the intellectual reach or the appetite of the audience. Now, the answer to that is not to throw up our hands and walk away in despair. If we do that, we do the nation a disservice. And despite public perceptions, very few stories of earth-shaking consequence haven't been told on commercial television, yes, and in prime time. It's always been a challenge in this country to expose racism. Some of the audience, let's be honest, feels threatened and uncomfortable. They see our promos, maybe they won't watch. But we did the stories anyway. Pauline Hanson, before she imploded, showed there were a lot of rednecks out there. I suspect we at Nine, and Ray Martin in particular, lost quite a few fans and paid quite a high price when we kept quizzing her about her ill-considered beliefs. Let's hope her self-destruction has made racism unfashionable. Frankly, I doubt it has. Another champion of intolerance will raise his or her ugly head before too long. As I said, we have to try harder in television to tell the stories that matter, stories that affect our future. I'd advise television journalists in particular to find an angle. Don't try to write the history of the world on the head of a pin. If necessary, choose a key element of a story and cover it well. It's almost impossible to examine every detail in 1 hour, let alone 5 minutes. And I have to admit also that television is not the best medium in the world for conveying information. Unless you spend hours and hours on the replay button, words are spoken and vanish. There is such a thing as too much information, verbal overload. Television's great strength lies in conveying a mood or an impression, a simple message, not a complicated one. And we have tools at our disposal to deliver that information, music, visual effects. If the audience gets emotionally involved, laughter, anger or tears, so much the better. That's the true meaning of sensationalism, appealing to the emotions. Avoid beat-ups, which is what most people mean by sensationalism. Be wary of miracle cures. I address that in particular to Channel 7. If the Catholic Church sees the need for a devil's advocate, why should we be any different? The Catholic Church doesn't believe in every miracle. Neither does our audience. The public is getting wise. There are too many people on our case. And I welcome them, sometimes at great personal expense. We've got to put our own house in order, and I think we are. But there's still a few mongrels out there doing their business on the carpet. With journalism, I think, it comes down to trust. As journalists, I'm sick of hearing that we're on the nose, yet I admit we are. and we've only got ourselves to blame. There have been too many shortcuts in the past, too many inaccuracies. And now some people hate us. How do we get them to like us again? That's the question. We'll never get them all back, nor should we. Our craft depends on getting some people offside, the silver tails, the shonks and so forth. But we'll only persuade the ordinary digger and his wife to trust us long term by showing the decency and dependability day in, day out, that we're all capable of, and in fact, which most of us show from day to day. Maybe we should be quicker to punish those who bring us into disrepute. After all, most of us aren't bad people. Some of my best friends are journalists. And since I became an interviewee, I don't think anyone has seriously misquoted me or taken me out of context. Mind you, I've been known to misquote myself a few times, particularly after lunch. It's been suggested that I might want to look into the future. And the future, of course, is now. And the beginning was the Word, and the Word, courtesy of Caxton, was in print, and the Word was print. Then there was radio and television news and current affairs and lifestyle programs and reality programs, and now artificial reality programs, otherwise known as Lab Rat TV. A lot of you will have seen Survivor, where Richard Hatch fished and schemed his way to $1 million. Well, there's more to come. Station near you. There's Big Brother, for instance, where 24 cameras and 50 microphones track 10 people's movements for 100 days in one purpose-built house. Nothing they do escapes the gaze of the cameras, even when they're in the bathroom. By the end, there's only one of them left standing. The others have been voted out by their housemates or by the television audience. Now, newspaper coverage of this program in England was absolutely massive. So big that when a particular character called Nasty Nick was expelled from the house, he got more column inches than the Russian submariners lost on the Kurtz. There are at least two new adaptations of this genre, and this is not a joke, this is for real. One's called Orange Taxi, where the lucky contestants not only have to shack up together, but get to drive a taxi as well. And my personal favourite from Germany bears the nickname Big Blubber. In this version, 10 fat people are locked in a house. Every week, the one who loses the least weight is thrown out, and the lucky winner is rewarded with the equivalent of the pounds that he or she has lost in gold bullion. Now, this is a real format, and it might come here within the next few months. Where's it all going to end? God knows. When's it all going to end? Pretty soon, I guess, because this is sort of top 40 television. What's hot one week is stone cold the next. I'll leave the internet and the developments there alone because I'm too old to understand it, and sick of getting withering looks every time I ask some bespectacled nerd, how are you ever going to make money out of the thing? As I said, when I started in television in Mount Gambier, news was the only option for a journalist in television. Last year, I was asked to nominate the number of shows for which I was responsible at Channel 9, what I was supposed to accept some degree of responsibility for. It's the sort of trick question you get at contract time. And I said 23, which is pretty right. I think it's about 25 now. I'm not saying this to magnify my position, but to say that in this supposedly sunset industry of free-to-air television, there is still a massive appetite for information of all kinds. And whenever you read about commercial television in particular being on the nose, you'll note that news, current affairs, lifestyle and reality shows made by Australians for Australians are among the most popular items on the menu. But I'm getting to you soon, John Doherty. Like my mother once said, is popularity a cheap virtue? Is the worthy sludge of yesteryear being replaced by the so-called froth and bubble of shows like Harry's Practice, Backyard Blitz and Changing Rooms? The answer is yes. We're not replaced exactly, but overwhelmed. I know that many among you probably only ever watch the ABC, unless there's a particularly salacious movie on SBS. There's a certain cachet that comes from only ever watching the ABC. It's a bit like being a member of the Melbourne Club. Of course, if everyone who actually claims to watch the ABC actually watched the ABC, I wouldn't have a job, and neither would most of my colleagues at 7 or 10. I mean, the fact is, and the ABC's in turmoil at the moment, so I can't resist giving it a kicking, the ABC has not moved with the times. I don't even know if it wants to move. And if it does, it doesn't know in which direction. The 7:30 report, by all accounts, is a dead duck. Maybe John Doherty, who's sitting at the Channel 9 table here, would like to confirm that. And it's not just a dead duck because the shiny pants at Auntie decided to centralise it in Sydney, but because a whole host of other information programs have been thrown against it just about every night of the week. In fact, this week, every night of the week. Great Outdoors, Better Homes and Gardens, Our House, Getaway and Burke's Backyard. That's one week at 7:30. Tough competition. And all aimed at the ABC's predominantly over 40s audience. I don't want to knock the ABC any more than I have to, because it does some things extraordinarily well. It's a splendid training ground for commercial television. Four Corners and Today Tonight were pioneer programs. But Four Corners these days often takes 45 minutes to do something which, with our shorter attention span these days, probably only demands 15. The format, I believe, has reached its use-by date, and the ratings show that most Australians agree with me. But first and foremost, the ABC must decide if it wants to get locked in a ratings battle with the commercial networks. It can produce top-rating shows like Sea Change, damn it, but most of its popular fare, The Bill, Vicar of Dibley, etc., is imported. The one thing that no one here has discussed when they talk about the future of the ABC is that there's a huge audience out there that none of the commercial stations really want. I'm talking about the over 50s. The advertisers don't want them. Kelly Stokes has fixed the upper limit of his target audience at 38. Channel 10 loses interest of its audience as soon as they reach puberty. And Channel 9 is becoming increasingly embarrassed that some of its viewers are as old as I am. So there's an opportunity for you, Auntie. John, 27% of Australians are over 50, and they're getting more and more every year, and they're becoming increasingly unloved on commercial television as television becomes more and more ageist. We know that older viewers are more loyal and less fickle than their sons and daughters. Also, they're more conservative. So here's a way that the ABC can reconquer the heartland, stop the budget cuts, and win over John Howard at the same time. The other John Howard. Even if it costs a few lefties their jobs. I'm only half joking, by the way, because one of the big issues of the future is the alienation of older viewers. And there's another big issue on the horizon. No doubt many of you despair at the quantity, at the quality, probably the quantity as well, but certainly the quality of some Australian television shows. So do I. And none of them on Nine, of course. But inevitably, there'll be more and more television channels. We used to have four or five, we've now got about 45. And each of these channels will require content. As the number of stations increases, the number of viewers on each station will shrink. The result? More programs required on smaller budgets. And if that's not a recipe for mountains of crap, I don't know what is. It'll be a brave management that spends millions of dollars on an offbeat program like Sunday in that sort of climate. And while I've got the crystal ball out, another fearless prediction. Less and less television will be produced in Adelaide, or anywhere else for that matter, except Sydney or Melbourne. Do you remember when Ernie Sigley used to host a Tonight Show in Adelaide? Never again. Networking's the go. Channel 10 couldn't see the point of firing up a studio here so George and Nikki could read Adelaide news in Adelaide. It deported them to Melbourne. Did Adelaide care? Not really, judging by the ratings. In fact, Channel 10 News usually gets a better audience in Adelaide than it does in Melbourne. Maybe they should read the Melbourne news out of Adelaide. Maybe distance does lend enchantment. That said, Channel 9 here has done very well with postcards from South Australia. Not exactly big budget stuff, but very watchable. Well presented, well edited, and it brings a rosy glow to my South Australian heart. And of course, as a network, we stole the idea, that's stolen quotes, and transported it to Western Australia and Victoria. We have to keep one eye on the bottom line in this day and age, but we should also keep an eye on the parish pump. And here too is a message for the ABC. It can swim against the tide, an activity which it does very well. It can service its local markets because parochialism pays. And the commercial networks, I think, are going to ignore the parochial markets at their peril. This is starting to sound a bit like a media lecture, but I'll finish it on one more serious note. And I think the quality of the audience and the tone of the occasion demands that. I think we spend too much time debating non-issues, such as whether information can possibly be entertaining or entertainment can possibly be informative. What matters most is that every shade of opinion and every colour of thought should have an outlet somewhere. I'm particularly proud that for 19 years, Nine has presented the Sunday program. I won't pretend a lot of people watch it, not nearly as many as say they do. It's our private ABC. But when it comes to the image of the Nine network as an agenda setter and a forum for debate, no program is more vital. Some critics have suggested that we should schedule Sunday at 7:30 Sunday night in place of 60 Minutes. That would be a great move. It would inevitably die. We'd have to sack the staff, which wouldn't be a good result for them or us, and I think for Australia. Many shows we produce, like Sunday, Business Sunday, the Small Business Show, or Dotcom TV, the newcomer, would never make it in prime time. The important thing is that the bases are covered and that the constituencies are serviced, that their voices be heard, even if it's not in prime time. We can record it if we want to and play it in prime time. Only recently we saw how a torch lit up a nation, the Olympic torch. Now we carry another torch in our uncertain, fallible hands, and it's more important than the Olympic torch, so let's not stumble too often. And as for Dick Wordley, I'd like to give him the final word. He was on his deathbed when I sent him some flowers and a note with some rather lame, poorly expressed wishes for his recovery, saying, "For once, Dick, the story doesn't come first." Dick may have been dying, but he was in no doubt. The story still comes first. And those untold were his final words. Cheers, Dick.
Working? It is. It's a miracle. You can't get away. You see, you can't get off the stage. I saw you climb up here and that was a struggle.
No, I didn't realise the steps down there.
No, I don't think you could get off. You'd have to go down the stairs. I want to say one thing before I call on questions, and we like to encourage questions from the media groups first of all, but I want to say that Richard Wenke, your mate from Mount Gambier, did a terrible thing and bought a patch of grapevines in the Barossa Valley where he now lives, and he makes his own wine, and up to 3 months of the year he actually puts in hard work. So you and I have taken the wrong turn somewhere, haven't we? I would now like to call on questions. As I say, I encourage questions from the media first. Anyone like to ask Peter, who's quite clearly a limp and timid in anything he says, to is there anyone like to throw a question at him?
It's on. Peter Jeremy Cordova.
Yes, I know the name and the face.
Well, you very kindly put up with me while I tried to read the late news on Channel 10 those years ago. What happened to Ellen Fanning? Why is she leaving?
That's a very good question. It's a very simple answer. She did it for nearly 2 years and she thought the travelling was just too much for her. She just didn't like the lifestyle. Loved the job, hated the lifestyle, wants to spend more time at home.
Well,
that simple. I mean, lots of people read more into it, but I don't expect to see her anywhere else. Phil Donahue, this is a cameraman at 60 Minutes, who's worked at Channel 9 for 36 years. Phil Donahue, the executive producer of the program, decided, and that's within his rights, that it was time for a change, for professional reasons, not personal ones.
I think on behalf of the ABC, John Doherty from the ABC, by the way. I think I just need to correct Peter on one or two points. I think I have a right of reply. I'd just like to say that I think programs like Four Corners, I believe, are still fulfilling a great function for the Australian community, and the great worthiness of that program is it sometimes tackles issues that I think the commercials wouldn't do. And I think that is one of the great strengths of the ABC, that's prepared to get in there and have a go independently. And maybe we don't rate as well as we should, but keep watching.
Well said, John. You're a loyal ABC employee so quickly.
And don't you like the conservative suit and tie?
That's not what he used to say to me when he worked at Channel 9, by the way.
Robert Main from the Bulletin magazine. I've just been reading Gerald Stone's book. You've read it?
Parts of it, yeah.
Parts of it, okay. I've read a bit about when Kerry sold the Nine Network to Bond. He called you into a rather tearful, I think it was described by Gerald, a tearful conference at Willoughby, and he gave all his departmental heads, I think including you, and this is my question, $500,000, is that right?
$500,000? I certainly didn't get $500,000 for anything. Who gave me $500,000? Kerry?
Well, that's what Gerald Stone said, all the departmental heads, and I imagine you were in one of them.
No, I didn't get $500,000, but I'll send him an invoice tomorrow. Thanks for doing that.
Are there any more media questions? No, we've got another taker.
Rebecca Devlin from the Age newspaper. I'm just wondering what attempts Channel 9 are making to get the exclusive story of Miss X, Ingrid Odgers.
I don't know. I imagine that we'll be making approaches to her, but I don't know quite what the result of it is.
And
it's usually done at an operational level by, in this case, no doubt, the producers of 60 Minutes in A Current Affair.
And how much would you think that you'd be willing to pay?
Not a huge amount. We sort of don't conduct our business openly when it comes to negotiating prices for interviews. I personally regret that we pay for any, and I think Kerry Packer would share my concern there that he keeps his money in his pocket. But I don't think this is the sort of thing that would be worth a huge amount of money, no.
Well, just
I mean, I'm talking, you know, five figures rather than, I'm certainly not talking six.
Well, what is the justification usually for checkbook journalism when you justify that?
Well, I think the reason that we pay for some interviews is that we wouldn't get them any other way. And I think as long as we disclose the payment and as long as we stick to our principles of not paying criminals or people accused of criminal offences, it's regrettable, but I don't have a great problem with it. I hope never. I mean, a lot of Channel 9 news is read out of Sydney and Melbourne. Most Channel 9 programs emanate from Sydney or Melbourne, but it'd be a very sorry day if Channel 9 news in Adelaide was read out of Sydney or Melbourne. Because, as I said before, I think NWS here has shown Australia the way to a degree with postcards from South Australia and with the strength of their local news. I, as someone who lived in Adelaide once, I shudder to believe that anyone could accept news read from some remote part of Australia like Sydney.
Thank you.
immediate, to the daily present. Three public questions.
Where's the first one?
McDonald's
reference. The Lord Mayor has a question. I'm not sure that he's the working press, but he's in that often enough.
Yes,
most of the time that we see the end of a question, and I'm not going to let this opportunity go without ask one question. My question is really a very simple one. With the technology, do you see one day we'll have all the commercial stations based outside Adelaide?
I think that's
in the near future. I'm talking about 5 or 10 years.
Well, I think most of the networks are based outside of Adelaide or Brisbane or whatever. But I think what we've got to try and preserve is an element of, you know, parochialism or regionalism, because a lot of people are most interested in the news closest to home. But they're the issues that they can get a handle on, they can identify with. And I think if we become too remote from our audience by giving them a diet of material that's been assessed by people in Los Angeles or Sydney or Melbourne, I don't care where, I think they're going to go elsewhere. And I think that there's always a very strong market for local news, and I think we've got to continue to service that market. We've got to acknowledge the fact that people in Adelaide want to hear Adelaide stories. If we desert that stronghold, I think we're going to lose our audience.
Peter, Ben Fordham, a current affair. Your cheesecake is waiting down here, I should tell you.
No, okay, thanks.
Is that the question? No, it's not. I just wanted to ask you, we hear from time to time about the Packer influence in books and stories, and I want to ask you directly, have you ever received the phone call? Is there a Kerry Packer phone or a James Packer phone? Do you ever receive the phone call saying that story is unacceptable or I don't want that story to go to air?
How come I get the most difficult question from one of my own employees? No, Terry Packer and James Packer have separate phones, and I don't. I don't have a hotline to Kerry or James or the White House. But I last spoke to Kerry, I think, about 4 months ago when he asked me to go to India and look at a whole lot of Hindi language soap operas, which was a lot of fun. And I last spoke to James about 3 days ago. But I have frequently, when I say frequently, about say 3 or 4 times a year, had calls, not from James, but from Kerry, saying, oh, I hated that story. If that's the best you can do, maybe you better get yourself a job somewhere else. I've had a number of calls like that, maybe 3 or 4 a year at most. But I've never had a call before the event saying, do that story. He rang Gerald Stone once and complained about a story on 60 Minutes. This is about 15 years ago. And Kerry said, Gerald said, well, Kerry, I appreciate your feedback. We appreciate feedback from all our viewers. And Kerry said, I thought you'd regard me as more than just a viewer. At least I'm 2 viewers. But you get... really solid, what shall I say, sometimes colourfully expressed feedback from Kerry, but he is an exemplary proprietor in the sense that he doesn't say, do a story on this, do a story on that.
What about not doing a story on that?
No, same thing. You don't get lay off this, lay off that type of instructions. And by the way, we've just recently hired one of the best journalists in Australia from the Bulletin, a guy called John Lyons, former editor of the Sydney Morning Herald. Working a world-winning journalist, and you know, absolutely straight as a gun barrel. There's no way that he would have come to work for us if we'd given him writing instructions. And neither would Laurie Oates, and neither would most of the people who work there.
Question up the back.
Thank you. Barry Barrett, public relations consultant, and involved with agricultural journals. As a family, we're very keen on Channel 9. We watch the 6 o'clock news. We sit down to dinner during the current affairs, and we can test each other on the side of the new century. I also am a governor of a private school in Adelaide. And I was absolutely amazed and perhaps distraught to listen to the break in your news when the government's new attitude to private schools came out. I've never heard such a biased, untruthful account of the situation. Of wealthy schools, wealthy parents, and one of the greatest stories of rubbish I've ever heard on television. And there was no attempt to find out the facts that two parents work to send their kids to private schools. The private schools are living on the money that's been put in years and years ago, that their finances are desperate and things like that. And I've never heard such a lot of rubbish. And I think it would be quite fair, sir, if you apologised for your initial comment saying fellow searchers for truth, because Channel 9 doesn't do that.
Well, thank you for that feedback. I didn't see the story of which you're complaining. I'll certainly make it my point to have a look at it when I get back. I did say searches for the truth, and I also said that we carry a torch in our fallible hands. So I've never claimed to be 100% right or that our staff is 100% right. We sometimes do make mistakes. I believe if we make a mistake, we should apologise for it immediately and set the record straight.
Would you like my card?
I'd love your card.
Got another question at the back.
What a pleasure to see public relations consultants alive and well in Adelaide. Remembering Alfred Hitchcock's great line, drama is real life with only the boring bits left out, and in view of all of you have said in your address, what is the single story that you personally are most proud of, and the context of that story in the now, current and near future broadcasting landscape?
The story of which I'm most proud. I mean, that is... to be honest, I've never even thought of that question. There are so many stories that I'm really proud that we've done, and the Paul Keating story was one. I think there's a very important one coming up on the ABC next Sunday, on Sunday program. I think our profiles of Pauline Hanson have been good because they've been fairly fearless and they copped us a fair bit of flack. But I honestly haven't sort of gone through a hit parade of these are the stories I'm most proud of. One of the programs, it's strange, it's not a journalistic thing, one of the programs I'm most proud of is RPA. Because it goes further than most programs have gone. It's far more gritty. It proves that the audience has a taste for reality far beyond what we would have believed, and it's done with great dignity and yet with maximum intrusion at the same time, which is bizarre. But great pieces of journalism. I think the one that would stand out, and I think about it, is probably the investigation into Chelmsford Hospital and all the patients who died there receiving electroconvulsive therapy.
There's a question right at the back. Mignon.
Mignon Noreti Ellicott, formerly ABC. Peter Meakin, I was absolutely appalled at your criticism of the ABC. Maybe you've explained it, but I am still appalled. Thank you.
I expected a number of people to be appalled by my comments, and that's one of the reasons I made them.
Well, one more question. Final question, I believe. Two questions. We've got two to go. Peter Meakin, Ian Hinsky, ABC.
Yes.
One of the things you mentioned was the coverage of local current affairs. The ABC went from a national to a state, went from a state-based program to a national program. Channel 7 actually moved in and did Today Tonight, which I worked on for a short time here in Adelaide, and it actually managed to outrate Ray Martin, a former ABC employee, of which most of your key staff are. But anyway, I just wondered whether there was a lesson
I'll
in there.
I'll correct that, by the way. I didn't outright my Ray Martin. It did. There were times when it's beaten, but not, I don't think, when Ray Martin was there. Pam Gardner will correct me if I'm wrong on that point.
There were a number of times when it outrated him. But anyway, the thing I was wondering was, is there a lesson there? You talked about the opportunity for local stations to become part of the local scene, and yet Nine has always resisted a local current affairs program. Is there any reason for that other than money?
Certainly that there are advantages in doing a national program. In my view, in some ways there are more advantages in doing a local program. The advantages of having a national program is that you speak with one voice and you can say, come on to our program, to the Prime Minister, whereas hard for five local programs to get him on. So you do have a certain national clout, but you stumbles along the way, one of which you referred to, and we were sort of set in concrete. Now, it was a clear alternative for Seven to try the local version, and in some markets it's worked well for them, I agree. And the ABC went the other way. But I think by and large, I'd love to be able to do more local stories. The ideal situation is to have locally based programs with a strong national presence, but that is a damn sight more expensive than doing one national program. Money comes into most things, even at the ABC, and as you're about to find out.
I'm Sally Roberts from the ABC. Just wondering, with all this introduction of reality TV coming in, is there really a place for current affairs in the future? What do you see the direction of current affairs?
I think there's always a place for current affairs. I don't think there's a place necessarily for any more current affairs. But, I mean, good heavens, we've got a whole host of programs at the moment. I can't see there's room for any more of them as pure current affairs. But I don't see reality television as being a threat to current affairs. I just think it's a new genre, just as lifestyle programs are a new genre. There's more and more programs which are information-based. And the great thing is it's going to provide more and more work for more and more journalists, cameramen, editors, producers, sound recorders, and God knows what. I think that is the most optimistic view of the future, is we're going to need more and more content, factual content.
Mike, this is the final question. We're actually over time, so...
Peter, Frederick Turner, who once used to work for the ABC, but now work for the Adelaide Institute, could you please identify or define for me the concept politically correct and how that would impact on your Channel 9 work?
I'm sorry, I'd have to ask you to repeat that, because I define the concept politically correct.
Yeah, the politically correct concept, you know, there are so many people who are politically incorrect. Could you elaborate on this and how this impacts on your moral framework?
I know what political correctness is. I'm not certain that I'm terribly politically correct. I can't see anywhere where political correctness impinges on our work. I think if anything, we set out to taunt the sacred cows.
Peter, thank you very much for coming today. We enjoyed very much your address, which I said was timid and shy. Good range of questions, excellent answers. I can't offer you the freedom of the Barossa Valley, but I've got one bottle here that you might like to liberate at some stage. It's one of our better ones from this part of the world. Thank you very much for coming down to see us today. Thanks for Channel 9 for giving him a day off. And we hope to see you again in the relatively near future. Thanks very much indeed, and thanks for all coming.
Thank you for making me so welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you for being a good audience. Thank you for
asking some decent questions, even if I couldn't answer a couple. And thank you for the gift. And my final thanks has to go to Dick Wordley and his family for being such a delight to know and to work with. Thank you.
Thank you, Rex, and thank you, Peter. Before you start talking, let's draw the raffle, and so grab your raffle tickets. And I'd like to call up Mark Coulson, General Manager of Channel 9, come up here and draw the raffle. Isn't he the most attractive man in Adelaide? He's just stunning.
Come up here. There we go, round this side.
No offence to your partner, but you've got no taste, have you?
So. Okay, for 6 bottles of wine from the Press Club cellar, what have we got, Mark?
Is it Mandy Jane?
Yes, Mandy Jane Giannopoulos. Mandy Jane? Where are you? Arts SA, Mandy Jane. Telstra have given us one of their slimline, colourful, U-Bute fun phones. Who have we got, Mark?
Rachel Hancock from the Sunday Mail.
Rachel Hancock, Sunday Mail. And another one of the Telstra fun phones.
Kate Jennings.
She's over there.
That's all?
No.
Right.
We've got a gift pack of 3 CDs, and they are Lennon Legend, The Best of John Lennon, Anthems by John Williamson, and soundtrack to the Mel Gibson movie, The Patriot.
Pauline Oliver.
Pauline Oliver.
Hello.
Where's Pauline? There she is. Walter Rogers, where are you? Here he is. Walter always comes up with a couple of vouchers. We have the $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe, where you can go and have some wonderful seafood in Googer Street. And who is it, Mark?
Vicky Lewis.
Hey, Vicky. And Walter also has a $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street for some fine Italian.
It's cut off a bit, but it looks like Peter Campbell.
Is he there?
No, is that Peter Campbell?
Peter Campbell?
Yep.
Yes, yep. There yep. He is. And for a carton of Hahn Premium from SA Brewing, thanks to Robbie Cooter.
Mark Coulson.
Oh! No.
Alan Baskin.
Oh, Alan Baskin, news director of 5AD and 5DN.
That's worth a few plugs, Alan.
Yes, and a carton of Hahn Premium Light from SA Brewing.
Another one. Tobin.
Somebody called Tobin, E, as an E-ticket,
E44. Tobin.
Please thank Mark Coulson, General Manager of Channel 9. That's all for today. Thank you for your attendance, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.